Yeah, from the heart of nowhere to almost everywhere else. This is JP on Journeys with JP. I'm here in the north of Scotland, like the kind of little dimple in the right in the back, in the kind of skull of Britain. If it was skull, it would be in the back of the head, kind of probably about where the pineal gland would be. And that's where I am, just near Elgin. And tonight I'm speaking with show host and Arthur to my Batman to my Bruce Wayne to my Batman. Bruce Wayne to
Alfred.
Hey man,
it's your show. You've got to be the boss. It's your show. So I'm happy to be the Robin to your Batman, the Alfred to your Bruce Wayne. The Lefty to your Poncho, the Watson to your Holmes, the Speedy to your Green Arrow, the John Stewart to your Hal Jordan, the Galactus to your Silver Surfer. Yeah, you tell me. I got a million of them.
I know. You should write the book. You should publish a CD of them. This is indeed my guest, Sean David Morton. We've been on this kind of weird 6-hour kind of roundtable marathon thing. We did this show a couple of hours ago, and I've just replayed it, and we haven't had a chance to kind of like even take a breath. So we've got. There's about 10 minutes left of the interview with Cobra. So shall we listen to it together, and then we can skip off on that.
Let's rock that, and then it's because then I can turn off the recorder because we're archiving the show because we've had some challenges with the station, as you know, has had some challenges with YouTube. Although I still think that we should just get a Vimeo account and just leave YouTube in the dust altogether. So why don't you play the last part of that, and then that will then allow me to turn off the recorder when we're done. Okay.
Okay. Engage recorder in 5, 4, 3.
On the next three movies, I guess what, episode 7, 8, 9 or so. So it's and you have special coded messages that are posted on your blog, your 2012 portal. Blog. Why are the messages public? Is there any benefit to someone who doesn't understand the cipher, maybe being exposed to them when they're on your website?
Okay, I will explain. It is just a matter of convenience. There are certain agents of the resistance movement that need to get certain messages, and the easiest way to do it is through a public website. They can just go to any internet cafe and they just look at my blog and they get a message. They of course can decrypt it, nobody else can, and it's the easiest way to communicate certain parts of the operation. And of course the surface population can read about, they read those messages, they cannot decipher them, they cannot decode them. There was not even one successful decoding in 2 years of the blog from the surface population. So people can guess whatever they want. It's sometimes funny to read those comments. But yes, people can feel the energy behind, and they can actually connect with the resistance movement through those messages if they wish. But they are not meant for the surface population. They are meant for the agents of the resistance movement on the surface.
Is it possible to destroy this last layer of the Archon grid and repurpose it for positive, repurpose it for the children of light, if you will, and maybe where is the Archon grid being controlled from, and how might we destroy it and repurpose it for something higher?
Yeah, I would not say destroy, I would say remove the Archon grid, and then the etheric plane will be inhabited by beings of light, like angels, spiritual guides, and then those beings of light will inspire humanity into a completely different situation.
Okay. And how will the, and this is sort of, as we kind of wrap this up, what is the, how are the mystery schools going to return to us? I mean, we had the Pythagorean mystery schools, you supposedly had the, the centaurs like Charon, or Chiron, teaching the great heroes of the old days. How do the mystery schools return? Are they going to have, community colleges or, classrooms around the world? How do we get schooled in the mysteries that we're going to need for this new future that you envision?
Actually, after the event, certain members of the resistance movement and the Agartha network, at a certain moment, will come to the surface and will begin teaching again. And of course they can use the circuit infrastructure which exists here, classrooms, internet, physical locations where people will meet and will be receiving the mysteries from the mystery schools like it was thousands of years ago.
Okay. And what is it, what do they return to teach us? Let's wrap this up on a positive note. What is it, with all of your wisdom, Cobra, and all of your knowledge and all this, and like I say, I'm very impressed, and I can't thank you enough for this interview. It's been very enlightening for me. What is it they teach us? What is it that humanity most needs to know right now?
Okay, there will be many layers of teaching. There will be a layer of teaching for those who are on a spiritual path, and the main teaching for them will be ascension. Ascension being the transformation of consciousness and liberation of consciousness from space and time, from third dimension, actually enlightenment process, you might call it. And apart from that, there will be teaching for the masses, and the teaching for the masses will be basically, why am I here, or what am I supposed to do with my life, what is my life purpose, how to live in harmony with myself and with the others. Basic human relations, how to live in love with my brothers and sisters. That will be the basic teaching for all humanity. How to cooperate without fighting and without creating conflict. How to distribute abundance, how to rebuild a new civilization. That will be the basic teaching for humanity.
You think that's going to be difficult for us?
No. It will be difficult because the conditions will be different, because everybody will have enough to survive. People will not struggle for money. People will have advanced technologies on their disposal. They will not be manipulated through the mass media. They will not be threatened into anything. And people will finally begin to see that something good is happening, and they will have hope. They will have perspective. They will have a vision, and they will have a purpose in life.
Well, it's kind of hard to fight on Christmas morning when you get all the toys that you want. Are you going to fight with your brothers and sisters when you're opening all your presents under the tree?
That's the point, exactly. So people will be so happy that they will not have no more reason to fight, and they will not be manipulated from the etheric archon. They will not be bombarded by spider waves. They will not have to go to fight a war for the Illuminati bankers. They will be able to build their life constructively, to be creative, and at a certain point to join our cosmic brothers and sisters, to join the galactic union of all the civilizations of light, to travel throughout the galaxy and to explore the universe. That's the future of the human race.
Amen. iPods and iPhones for peace. What do you say, Cobra?
Yeah.
That's the best way to do it. Can't thank you enough for being on here. I think it's, I think your viewpoint is fantastic. I think it's very uplifting. I think that, I'm not sure we have that long a way to go quite yet. I try to point out to people that the whole world was getting along actually pretty fine between 91 and 2001, that the dark forces, the dark lords, the black hats, the reptilians, the archons, whatever it is you want to call it, they had to work really hard to put 9/11 together. I mean, even then, when it was just a random terrorist like Osama bin Laden, which is what they claimed, and then expanding that into a war into Afghanistan, and then of course Iraq, and now trying to expand the war into Syria and Iran, and failing dismally, and toppling governments and all across the Middle East or so. I just point out to people how hard the whole New World Order Illuminati gang has to work to make us hate each other, to make us all go to war. And I thank you for shining the light of truth and peace and knowledge and understanding upon these dark recesses on Earth. I can only say bless you, sir, in your mission, and I hope we can meet very, very soon. And of course do you want to give people your website again, please?
You can go to my blog. You can just Google Portal 2012 or Cobra Portal 2012, and you will find it very easily. And if you're interested in new technologies, you can go to tachyonis.org, tachyonis.org. And if you want to join us, we are having an activation in Switzerland on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You will find all that information also on my blog. So I would like to thank everybody for listening, and I hope we can see each other soon in a liberated, on the liberated surface of planet Earth.
Amen. And once again, life has purpose. life has purpose. All is one. God is love. I very much appreciate you, you folks for joining us. I can't thank you enough. Once again, to explain it, if all is one, then that means we are biologically connected to each other. We're chemically connected to the Earth, and we are atomically connected to the entire cosmos. If life has purpose, then that means that every low kick, dirty trick, and rotten lick you've taken throughout your life puts you in the exact right point in time at the exact right moment in history to be the hero that you need to be. And if God certainly is love, then that means that the prima mobile of the universe is for the greatest and highest good of every being in that universe. And it's a strange universe, and we just work here. And I want to say thanks to everybody for joining us today. And thank you, Cobra. Once again, his blogspot, or should I say his blog and website, 2012portal.blogspot.com. Cobra, thank you again. Appreciate your knowledge, appreciate your wisdom, and fight on. I appreciate you being here.
Okay, thank you everybody for listening.
Thanks again, sir. Bye-bye. And there we go. And we're done.
And we're done. There we go. Hello. Well, Sean, you there? No, he's gone. He's just making sure that his tape recorder is finished. He can stop it now. Now, let me just make sure that all my buttons are in the right way so that everybody can hear me. There you are.
How are you?
Yeah, go on. And standing by. And so, yeah, here we are. So, this is Journeys with JP, with Sean, having just done this kind of, almost round table with Steve Travesty and Cobra and myself recording the whole little business and then broadcasting it straight away. And then, there's not enough time because we didn't time it right. And so there's not enough time to accommodate all of Sean's show. So it's spilling over. There will be a single archive, I have MP3s of everything, so that's not... Oh, my God, what was that? Something just made a big noise behind me. That's a very interesting sound. I don't know what that sounds like. Something dropped onto the radiator. Anyway, very good. Anyway, yes, here we are. Sean, are you with me? Are you there? Let me join hands and see if I can raise... the ghost of Sean David Morton. Oh, no, he's away. He's probably answering a phone call.
Good man, are you there?
Hey, Manny. We're here.
Ah, you're right, you fucking bastard, yeah. What are you up to, you bond?
Anyway, there you go. I'm sorry, we were on a delay here, obviously, so I had to go in and turn off the mic.
It's a weird kind of time travel thing when you pre-record a show knowing that you're going to be playing it and like before you've almost before you finished it that you start playing it again. So, but anyway, it was all pretty graceful though. It all dropped in.
And thank you, and I have you to thank for it. So thank you very much. We couldn't have done it without you. Cobra insists. I understand it a little bit. It is kind of funny when I did hear him for the first time. His just regular voice is you did a lot to it. Let's put it that way. You put some bass into it, some basso profundo. Let's put it that way. And it's very interesting. So even though he appears places, and even though he speaks publicly, he, for whatever reason, insists that his voice be modulated over the air.
Have you got any growls in you?
Well, it's probably because his voice sounds a little like this, actually. So that's why.
Yeah, you want some?
All right, anyway, brother. Riding that microphone. You've been riding that microphone for about 6 hours now. That's
riding the saddle, boy. Riding the saddle.
That is strong tea, my friend.
I've been eating eggs. I've got these lovely chickens, and they're supplying me with 2 eggs a day, which is great because they're only tiny. That's great. You know, it means that I get free eggs, and I can even trade with them. So, because I can't eat that many eggs. I'll never go to the toilet again. Sorry, you can't say that. Anyway, meanwhile, welcome to Journeys to the Bathroom, with JP and my guest tonight, Sean David Morton.
Thank you for elevating the conversation right away,
JP. That's right. We got it. We got make sure we've got our base covered, and then hosed down a lot. And then we've been talking with Cobra, who is a most interesting character. You know, you're a reader, Sean. You listen to this guy. You were kind of there, you know. What was the impression that I get from him, right, is he's really earnest. He's like totally focused. And it's like, I imagine that's what extraterrestrials are like. That they're not like, hi, oh, hi, JP, you know, yeah, how you doing, mate?
Talking to Cobra is a lot like that terrifying moment when your cat enters the room, stares up at something that you can't see, and then runs away in sheer terror. That's what talking to Cobra is a lot like. Because you're looking around going, what? The cat just comes in, looks at something invisible, and then just goes and shoots out of the room. And that's what Cobra is really talking like. You're wondering if it's there, if it's not there, if it's real, if it isn't real. It pulls you into this entire farcical David Wilcockian sort of reality where you just don't know what's true and what isn't. And, it borders, whenever you have anyone who's anonymous like this, and unfortunately, when you're in the world that we are in, you have to rely on these sources because, revealing the information they reveal could, and we always, it's one of those things where I'm constantly saying that conspiracy theorists are always right. It takes us a little longer. It takes more time because the mainstream media gets their information basically fully digested and regurgitated into their mouths like little birds, if you will. It's just spoon-fed to them. So they get to simply parrot whatever the party line is. We don't have journalism anymore, and not in this country anyway. We don't have investigative reporting at all, unless it's something that doesn't matter, unless it's something about, a guy charges you more for a muffler or something, or it's a phone service. It's not something that matters. When I was working in television, which hopefully we'll go back to here pretty soon, but I was working on a show called Hard Copy. And I got to pitch a lot of stories to Hard Copy. I was a freelance independent producer. And I would go into Lisa Gregorius's office. And Lisa was this big brassy blonde with these huge breastises. She looked like a stripper. Had this big mane of blonde hair with these gigantic boobs. And then she went on to found like Court TV and a lot of other shows. She was she was actually a great person to work for. She was really fun. But in order for me to pitch various stories, I had to come away with not just the serious stuff, but tabloid stuff as well. For example, we did a whole story. We did stories on the Phoenix lights, actually, way back in 1997 and 98. And the original appearance of the Phoenix lights, which was, I think, St. Patrick's Day, actually, March 17th or so of 97, was never reported on the national news. It wasn't until the Phoenix lights actually came back in January of 1998, and these triangles and these gigantic ships were flying around Phoenix, Arizona, that I pitched it again to Hard Copy. And the only reason I was able to do it was because we went to Sedona, Arizona, to do a story on Sedona, America's mysterious Mecca. And we did a story on a lady friend of mine named Cynthia who lived in the woods and was a Native American shaman, even though she was a gorgeous blonde, blue-eyed girl who had two gigantic pet wolves. I mean, I'm talking about Game of Thrones-sized pet wolves, huge pet wolves. And a story on her, and then we did the story on the Phoenix lights. And driving back, we actually got a story on the Hawaiian Tropic girls or something. But, we managed to get away with a lot of stuff because you could put a story about TWA Flight 800 being crashed or Princess Diana and her murder assassination in between Madonna's lesbian love kiss and Cybil Shepherd dated Elvis and all that because you were doing the tabloid stuff. And actually, when we started a program within the program, a special segment which was called The X-Man, we got pulled, but the president of Paramount came in and said, what are you doing? You can't put these stories on TV. You can't educate people. You can't tell people the truth. I mean, this is what they told us. You can't tell people the truth on the second largest syndicated program that airs at 7:30 at night right after Entertainment Tonight. And we were the number two biggest show in syndication when Hard Copy got pulled. And the word came down from on high, from Mount, I don't know, Stoop Olympus or wherever it comes from, that they wanted more stuff about nothing. They turned Current Affair, which used to be a fairly hard-hitting program, which I think Bill O'Reilly actually used to host, but they turned that into a celebrity smooch fest, and you know, so you're just seeing all these things kind of going away. So it's always interesting for me when you're dealing with people like Cobra on the inside. You know, are they real? Do they have the information they claim? You know, on the one hand, you've got somebody like Benjamin Fulford who has the credentials. He's got the pedigree. He ran the Asian economic desk for Forbes magazine. On the other hand, then you have, again, people like David Wilcock, who just basically pull stuff out of their ass and say, oh, I've got a contact in the government and I've got this person and that person and the other. And, you know, and I'm in a situation as well where I've used sources of people who I know what their credentials are and I know that they are vettable sources, but I'll never be able to reveal who and what they are. And of course, I mean, even in the book that I wrote, Sands of Time was the last gasp effort, and I think this had a lot to do with my history with places like Area 51, with my willingness to be able to come out with this information, with my interactions with a guy named Ghost Walker, who was an assassin. He was an assassin who claimed to have been also stationed at Area 51, who, when I was working for Geraldo Rivera, came out and said, I've got a stack of documents, it's like 500 pages, and I've got pictures, I've got kill orders, I've got all the information on the 60 people that I've been sent after, if you will, you know, to calling him the government's retirement program, the one bullet retirement program. And I had this guy sleeping on my couch for a week with me with a gun under my pillow. And he was a super soldier. He was somebody that I watched this guy do acts of athleticism that were unparalleled. I saw him do, I mean, he could have been a talented athlete. He could have been a talented gymnast. He could have been something. But this guy was 6'4", solid muscle, probably 225, had gold eyes, had a big scar across his face. And look, I'm not kidding you, looked like Doc Savage from the comic books, if you will. And this guy did stupefying things. I mean, he jumped up on top of the roof of a lifeguard stand from a standing stop on the beach. I mean, this guy jumped like 15 feet in the air, and you know, could literally bounce down the sidewalk on one hand, you know, just crazy stuff. You know, could do a 100-yard dash in like 9 seconds. It was just weird things. And when I was willing to take on a body of documents, which by the way never appeared, the guy vanished into thin air. He dragged us to Las Vegas. We had a whole security team ready to take him when he produced these documents, and he just disappeared, and you know, never heard from him again. But it's always weird when you're dealing with something. It's almost like dealing with channeled information. And people that channel, they're like psychic bullies. You know, they've got a conduit directly to God. How do you disagree with their information? And you know, I get a little tired of these new age types all the way back in 2008 who were telling me that Barack Obama was the Messiah, and some of them, like Richard Hoagland, apparently still believe that he is. And you and I both have information that goes the other way. So it's
which one, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just trying to explain to my friends the whole double Obama, the home affairs Obama who likes it with guys, and there's the foreign affairs who likes it with blondes. And Beyonce.
I'm telling you, I want to explore this because I am of the opinion that he has a legitimate double. I'm not talking about a clone. I'm not talking about anything else. But you will notice that the minute Obama gets outside this country, he's, oh my goodness, he's Don Juan. He's Mr. Casanova. He's like, you know, he's Frank Sinatra outside the country. The minute he gets in the country, he's all kind of, you know, whipped by Michelle. And I'm sort of wondering where this wanderlust is coming from. And there are people, I mean, they use doubles. I mean, Saddam Hussein used a double. Hitler supposedly had something like 9 doubles. I mean, I'm talking about people who already look like somebody and then are surgically altered to appear at public events and whatever else.
And Paul McCartney, we know about Paul.
Yeah, Okay, well, at least when Paul died in that car crash in November of 1966, we got a better Paul. I mean, I like the Paul we have now because he's
a bit of a psycho. I have to say, he's a bit of a psycho.
Yeah, everybody, and it's funny that you bring that up because you know everybody is afraid of Paul McCartney. Everybody, even George Harrison, when I asked him, was like,
oh, terrible. Hey, I just got a flash. I wonder if Paul McCartney is worse than Jimmy Savile.
Never heard that about him, but when you have women like, Heather Mills, I think it was, and she goes on TV and says things like, you know, I know where all the skeletons are buried. If something happens to me, you know, I've got a box that, I mean, she's on CNN talking about this.
Everybody wants to look in Heather's box, yes.
I know, yeah, but, I mean, people are just dog nuts afraid of Paul McCartney. And people also don't understand that it was him that broke up the Beatles because Linda Eastman, her whole family is lawyers, and I believe she was related to the Eastman Kodak, fortune, but it was her lawyers that basically started suing everybody and broke up the Beatles. John Lennon was like, wow, I always thought the Beatles would get back together, but you know, now I guess not when they started slicing up Apple, but that has nothing to do with anything. I'm just saying that in the realm of Cobra, we don't know who he is. We really can't vet who he is. You know, his opinion is his opinion. And, you know, who knows? He sounds to me like he's Swiss or has a European accent. I don't know that much about him. He does appear publicly. I mean, there was a tour that he was going to do to Bosnia, to the Bosnian pyramids. He was going to appear, I think he appears at a couple of conferences or so. So I don't understand the voice modulation thing, but you know, if that's his thing, that's his thing. It sounded cool anyway. And as far as the information that was out there, I don't know. Probably the only thing I would disagree with, I mean, he was pretty much dead on about it. The only thing I would probably disagree with is I am still really confused. You have all these people in the conspiracy world who are still saying that the Pope is terrible and he's awful and that he's a traitor and that, you know, even though he's the head of the Jesuits. And yet, on the other side, I have yet to see something really vile that Francis has done. Everything so far that I've seen him do, outside of there are people that feel betrayed by him because he's, you know, he's like, well, you know, you can go to heaven without really believing in Jesus and you can be gay and, you know, it doesn't really matter. And if you just have a heart full of love. And so there are people saying, oh my God, you know, he's not Catholic anymore. And
he's going to turn Jewish. He sounds like Dr. Zoidberg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's pumping everybody up for the whole new world religion and all that. And yet, every action that he's taken, whether or not he's been meeting with the Queen of England or whether or not it had to do, people do not understand how important the July 2013 apostolic letter, the papal bull that he put out, which removed the protection of the Roman Curia. When you understand that the Vatican lays claim to owning the government of the United States through a man named Archbishop Derek MacLeod, who's on 4th and Michigan Street in Washington D.C. at the Washington D.C. Archdiocese, and I've tried to get him on my show, and I am telling you, I've never seen anybody sing and dance like those people. It's just like, well, what do you want this for? And you know, oh, well, he's busy, and he just walked out the back door, and I'm sorry, I can't talk to you, and you know, his meetings with the Queen, and then all of these, as predicted. I talked about how all these financial people were going to start to get ganked, and here they go. There's about 30 of them that are dead now, and they're the lower-level people that could have really nailed the higher-level people. And, I mean, I'll give you an example. The two people that I thought were the most significant was the man who shot himself, committed suicide by shooting himself 8 times in the body and head with a nail gun in his garage in Colorado.
As you commit suicide, that's one of the most difficult ones. To do it like more than once.
The nail gun, yeah. It's like, ow, whoa, well, I'm not quite dead. No, I'm a little more dead.
Oh, not dead enough.
Yes, don't,
oh,
don't,
there's don't. Another one. No, not dead enough. 9-inch nails, never, not long enough.
So his partner then jumps off a roof and they don't find him for a couple of days because he jumps off the roof of a high building onto the 9th floor of another building. And they both ran these two desks where they were both, and this is JP Morgan again, where he ran, once again, the commodities desk in Hong Kong. And the only reason they actually found this guy's body was because the Hong Kong police, the Chinese police, raided that JP Morgan and started rounding people up and throwing them in jail and getting records and everything else. And somebody looked out the window and saw this guy's body that had been dead for several days. Actually, I think it was on a Friday, and these guys came in on a Monday. But, you know, once again, this was a person that could have fingered the higher ups. And so far, since JP Morgan has paid $60 billion in fines. $60 billion in fines. Nobody's gone to jail, but for all of their, financial shenanigans and whatever else, you know, again, are they too big to jail? Are they too big to fail? But I'm seeing something happening, and the Vatican is kind of behind it. And I would hope that if the Jesuits have finally come on down on the side of the angels, that, you know, and for me, it's good, you know, it's good fiction. It would be a great book to write that finally you have these Jesuit spies, these badass. Imagine James Bond and MI6, but with 1,300 years of training and unlimited assets and every amazing martial arts technique on earth and mind control techniques and whatever else. And imagine that. And then, you know, and then turn those loose on the Bilderbergers and the New World Order as the preparation for something else. But other than his, you know, I'm still, the jury's still out on Pope Francis. I pretty much agreed with everything else he was talking about. It's, you know, he talks about the White Dragon Society. He talked about that they only have access to bonds and not actual wealth. I would sort of disagree with him there. And I would disagree with him. You know, you and I both had been thinking for a long time. I mean, look at it this way. There's 192 countries, I think, on Earth right now, if my counting is correct. About 192. There could be more than that, but 192 countries on Earth. You would think that if these people truly want to change the world, and they truly had several trillion dollars to drop on somebody somewhere, and they truly had this technology, would we really declare war on Iceland as an example if somebody came in, private corporation or something, and built, you know, let's say you do an Epcot. Let's say you do an environmental or experimental prototypical community of tomorrow. And let's say you build it at a park or a World's Fair or something, and you have cars that run on water, and you have a Tesla coil that runs a city, and you have all these things, and you come in and you start setting this up. Would they really declare war on Iceland to cover all these things up? You now have the U.S. Navy running ships on seawater. So that was an accidental advance that had to do with cancer research. You actually had a scientist here in Southern California, I believe working out of the Keck USC Center. Don't quote me on this. I'm not sure about it. But I remember seeing the news piece where this doctor was using radio waves to affect different types of cancer. And he found that using a particular frequency of radio waves that he could light seawater on fire. And he had a glowing flame coming out of this with seawater on fire. And he said, well, I suppose you could use this to power a car or a truck or a city or something like that. And he looked really confused at the fact that this was a complete after effect of this, and that he looked really worried, actually. He looked like somebody was going to come in and whack him. There's still the designs of Stanley Meyer out there, which I don't know why, even though Stanley Meyer was then murdered, he was at an Applebee's, and these people were talking about financing his water-powered car. And he shot up in his chair and said, my God, I've been poisoned, and fell over dead in the parking lot of an Applebee's, which is probably what he gets for eating in an Applebee's. But his technology is still out there. You have all these people talking about a global change. Start with one place. Start with one country. Start with me. Start with you. Give us a bunch of money. Give Nighthawk a bunch of cash to build a farm that has all these technologies on it, and then protect it. And I would think that any sovereign nation, that Iceland be the best place to do it, because here Iceland has repudiated a $6+ billion debt, simply said, look, we've paid this over and over. We're going to repudiate the interest on this. We're going to throw the bankers in jail because they're crooks and they're creating money out of nothing. Then they threw out their entire government. Then they put anybody that wanted to be in the government, they put their names on ping pong balls, and they did a lotto to see who wanted to actually serve in the government. And now they have the greatest populist revolution, I think, ever. You heard not thing one about it in the Western press, by the way, because they were jailing bankers and repudiating debt, and the entire model that the rest of the world, like Greece or Spain, should take under advisement. We can never do it here in the United States because we actually have, in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the first line is, the public debt shall not be questioned. And that has a lot to do with the bankers and why we can't just repudiate the debt here. At one point, actually, this was interesting. At one point, the U.S. Treasury was minting a platinum coin. And there was a loophole in the law where these new platinum coins they were minting, there was nothing in the law that said that they, that said what the requirements were for putting a value on the platinum coin. And it was floated for a moment or two. Why don't you put a $1 trillion value on these coins, print 17 of them, and then march them over to the Federal Reserve and hand them to the Fed, and that would clear up the national debt. And it could have been just that easy. It wasn't until somebody found out about it and it was then leaked to the press that, you know, that they started going crazy, because people would then begin to understand how ludicrous and how fake the entire money system is, and how the entire monetary system of the United States is just, you know, is all, it's all made up money. It's not, it's all de facto, and it's all based on the, it's all based on the social security cards and the accounts of the people upon whose backs it's built. So, but, you know, that was an idea that was floated for a while.
So, meanwhile. Yeah. So, so that was it. Oh, great. Now where are we? So, bang.
I do have one of the, I've got one of the stories for you.
Go on.
Okay, well, this was really strange, because this happened here in Los Angeles, and it was totally passed over by everybody here. They're rebuilding the airport at Los Angeles, or LAX, L-A-X, like X-LAX, which I just think is funny that it's called LAX. And actually, as you come into the airport, there's a field of these huge plastic tubes that look like tampons, I'm not even kidding, that change color as you come in there. But they're rebuilding the international terminal, and something, a very unsettling series of events, arguably bearing a national security level threat to the entire United States, transpired, and this is the week of April 30th, because the FAA and the mainstream media, by the way, completely papered this whole thing over. I mean, they were just like, "Well, something weird happened in LAX, you know. Back to you, Bob." Because on April 30th, the FAA, as a consequence of what they called computer glitches, halted all outgoing flights from LAX, as well as all the other airports in the region, including Phoenix, SFO, San Jose, Salt Lake City, Las Vegas, and San Francisco. Basically, they just shut down all these airports. And so there was a report by NBC on May 2nd, and they said that this was a relic from the Cold War, which appears to have triggered a software glitch at a major air traffic control center in California that led to delays and cancellations of hundreds of flights across the country. And they said on Wednesday, this was on April 30th, at about 2 p.m., according to sources, a U-2 spy plane, the same type of aircraft that flew high-altitude spy missions over Russia 50 years ago, passed through the airspace monitored by the L.A. Air Route Traffic Control Center to Palmdale, California. And the L.A. Center handles landings and departures of the region's major airports, including Los Angeles, LAX, San Diego, Las Vegas, et cetera, et cetera. So on May 6th, you then have, and this was linked to the Drudge Report, you now have the Air Force, which officially denied, and we're talking a U-2 spy plane, we're talking about something that's over something like 50 years old, but now they denied that this was a U-2 spy plane, claiming that they found the glitch, but they provided no reason for what caused it. And this is what they said. They said, it's clear why the U-2 flew into the L.A. Center's airspace. It's still not clear why the U-2 flew into the L.A. Center's airspace, or why it didn't give advance warning of the flight as per usual. And according to NBC News, the nearby Edwards Air Force Base and NASA's Neil Armstrong Flight Research Center, located at Edwards, have been known to host U-2s. And again, U-2 spy planes, they were retired a long time ago. They were, as a matter of fact, at the same time the U-2 was flying, we were flying SR-71 Blackbirds that were doing Mach 3 to Mach 5 back in 1962. So this being an antique U-2 spy plane is very strange. But they say the U.S. Air Force, on the other hand, confirmed that it had sent out a U-2 plane that day, but denied that the spy plane caused the airport confusion. And here's what the Air Force said. They said, Pentagon spokesman Army Colonel Steve Warren confirmed that there was a U-2 operating in the area, and the Air Force filed all the proper flight plan paperwork, which, of course, they didn't, and in accordance with an FAA regulation, and was conducting a routine training op. And the FAA has issued a statement saying technicians have resolved the specific issue that triggered the problem, but the agency did not say what the problem was. And FAA spokeswoman Laura Brown declined to comment about whether the U-2 was connected to the computer problems. Now, this is really strange, because I'm just wondering if this was like a dry run for a was this a dry run for basically an electromagnetic pulse or something that could actually knock out the generators in an entire area? Because we're talking about whatever happened knocked out all the airports in the entire Pacific Southwest for the better part of a day. And 24 hours before the LAX shut down, all the passport scanners, by the way, went haywire at each of the passport scanners actually went haywire in England's airports. So all the scanners and all the security stuff in London went crazy first. Then you had all the stuff in the Southwest shut down. And now you have the Russians talking about how they've deployed strategic bomber fleets for flybys along the west coast of the United States to gather intel and test their capabilities. So is it possible that someone flipped a switch to see what might happen? And the Air Force likely knows what caused the outage but refused to share any of the details, which suggests, again, that either the United States was engaged in a military exercise and they want to keep it under wraps, because the one thing that could probably do that would be like a TR-3B Astra. The Astras have there's a quantum pulse drive in the center. It's a triangular-looking ship. It's got lights on the ends of the triangles that help the craft actually float. They're like repulsor rays. They allow it to float on the Earth's gravity field. And then you've got impulse engines that then push it along at a pretty cool speed. And then right in the center, you have this pool, this quantum field that could actually then engulfs the ship. It reaches through time-space. It bends time-space, if you will. And then the ship kind of pops out to wherever it is it's going to be. But the other question is, was this the Russians? And going public could really inflame an already very heated geopolitical climate that they just basically took a run at the Western U.S. Because the U.S. and Russia have all this advanced stealth and jamming systems, which we saw used, by the way, on MH Flight 370. But either of which could have been responsible for the outage. But the question is...
Or it could be a damaged TR-3B coming in hot from a battle.
That is actually true. And that's happened. That has happened a number of times, because back in 92 and 93, yeah, that's exactly right. Back in 92 and 93, there was a shuttle that we saw actually landing at Area 51. Myself and my dear departed friend John Hadley, who I also believe was murdered for a lot of the stuff that he saw. I saw more weird stuff in the company of my buddy John Hadley, who had a lot of very strange things going on with him, but he just inherited like $250,000 and just bought a brand new Jeep and all kinds of new equipment and then just went into his house and shot himself in the middle of the day. But John and I were out at 5-1 at the outskirts on the road and we saw this thing fly right over our heads and land. It was about 1600 feet from tip to tail and it was black on the bottom, white on the top, had a big blunt shovel nose on the front of it. And as I said, it looked like two doorstops, like two wedges, one on top of the other. And then the back end of it scooped up with three large retro rockets on the back. And there were all kinds of chase planes. There were F-16s and helicopters and all kinds of things around it. And it flew right over our heads and it came in and landed. It didn't fly in on the runway, which I thought was really strange. It flew over the town of Rachel, Nevada. A bunch of people saw it there. And then it went around and it landed coming in from the north. Whereas the runway at 5-1 is about 7 miles long and it comes in directly from the south, and that's usually where the Janet aircraft, it's the base is called Janet now. It's either called 5-1 by the people on the inside or Janet, which stands for, Johnson Airfield Nevada Experimental Test Site, because they renamed the base. It used to be called Glanet, which was the Groom Lake Airfield Nevada Experimental Test Site, but then they renamed it after Kelly Johnson, who was one of the founders of Skunk Works and supposedly one of the guys, along with Ben Rich, who were responsible for the stealth fighter. But this thing flew over our heads, came in from the north, and then just hung in midair and then landed. And it was preceded by this ear-shattering roar that actually broke one of the windows on the side of the truck. And whatever this thing was coming in from space, was reported on the news, and was causing what they called skyquakes or 3.0 earthquakes on the ground when it came in. And they were trying to, you know, this is Bill Moyer on Channel 7, said that there were two objects, and there was not two objects, it was just one, two objects that were coming in, that they landed at Area 51, that the military had no knowledge or would not admit to whatever it was, and that these were the things that were causing these massive tremors. Because it was very strange, because it was the opposite of an earthquake, whereas the ceiling in my house in Hermosa Beach actually started shaking first, then the walls started going, and then the floor. So it was the opposite, because then the windows would go, and it was similar to the double sonic booms that you heard, that we would hear, when the space shuttle would come in from space and then land at Edwards, except the booms were, you know, 10 times greater, and they were spaced further apart, because as this object comes in from space, the back end of it breaks the sound barrier first, and then the sound wave would then roll up about 1600 feet or so, breaking up the top. So you're absolutely right. This could be something coming in hot, landing it, and that's right in the approach corridor. Interesting enough that you mentioned that, because if it came in and landed at somewhere like 5-1, then you're looking at Vegas, Los Angeles, Phoenix. I'm not so sure about Salt Lake City, but, you know, all of these airports were blasted by whatever this was. And, we do have a weapon which is called CHAMP, and it's the High Powered Microwave Advanced Missile Project, and it's also manufactured by Boeing. And, you know, we hit every target that we want to. We do all that. But if it's the United States, because both the U.S. and Russia have all this advanced stealth technology, and the U.S., Russia, and China have all been testing non-nuclear capable electromagnetic pulse tech that can be deployed either via a missile or attached to an airplane while it travels in proximity to a particular target. It's not like the nuclear trigger super EMP weapons that you actually take and you explode like 50 miles up in the atmosphere, because that's capable of taking down the electrical infrastructure of an entire country. If it's detonated about 200 miles above the Earth's surface, if it's up that high, though, we're talking about the space station is only up about 150 miles, but if you did it about 50 miles above the planet. But these are all non-nuclear EMP tech. That's a line-of-sight weapon that can be directed at a specific city, building, computer systems. We now have something that they call it's Nikola Tesla. The hell did they call them? Tesla howitzers is what they call them, which is basically a Tesla gun that creates a huge plasma ball of energy that they've used on mosques and things in Iraq. But anyway, the U2 explanation wouldn't account for all the weird glitches that happened the day before in Britain, and it strains a lot of credulity to suppose that U.S. military activity would explain all the stuff that happened in the U.K. the day before. So what does that leave us with? More U.S. government conflicting stories, Russia, and the distinct possibility that the outages were once again attributed to either EMP love taps or could all just be a massive coincidence. But even if it is, there's still a very salient point to make. I mean, what sane person believes the flexible fascist Obama mainstream media would tell the truth if it were a hostile EMP test? Because it sounds more like something like Stuxnet or something like the Promise 2 software, which can very, very easily get into these things and actually turn things off. It was Promise 2. The fear was that if Promise 2 got into a nuclear reactor, as an example, and I talked about this on the radio like months before it became public, that Promise 2 could be used as a worm or a virus to shut down all the bells and whistles on a nuclear reactor and send the reactor into a China Center meltdown before anybody would know. And then I think 8 months later, that entire scenario actually turned up on a season of 24. That was the funny thing about being on something like Coast to Coast with Art Bell is, you know, I float all these things like detrodotoxin, which is a drug that mirrors death, and you wake up later from it, and then suddenly you see it all over the TV a few months later, or the stuff about EMP weapons or about these computer programs and all that. So I'm just saying that things are not as they seem, that we're going to war kind of behind the scenes in very strange ways, where everything is being kind of, you know, the tires are being kicked and tested in a lot of different weird ways.
So we've got lots of what we call exotic weapons, and you know what he was talking about was something that we were going, strangelet bombs. You know, it's like,
yeah, that's
okay. That's very sci-fi, isn't it?
Well, that would be like a strangelet bomb would be, you know, the only way I could sort of imagine it, and you're probably better at this than I am, but you know, as I understand it, when you're dealing with quarks, you have, I guess, right, left, charmed. There's a whole body of quarks.
Up, down, charmed and strange, or charm and strangeness. No, strange.
Strange, right. Strange. And the strange one was, strange are the ones that baffled Einstein. And Einstein was the one that said, I mean, they really bothered him because, and that's why he called them strange motion at a distance, because the strange quarks were basically the ones that they would bounce up and down and another quark completely disconnected from that one, that one would start bouncing up and down as well, with no apparent connection. Uh-huh. It's almost like
quantum entanglement things.
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Ah, excellent.
But what do you have when you've got a bomb that's made out of this stuff? What exactly happens? Does the bomb? This is a very Grant Morrison Invisibles type of reality here. If you exploded a strange motion at a distance bomb, a strange let bomb, what would occur? Would you have a complete alteration of the reality of time and space within the field? Could you actually warp something into another universe, another time space, another reality? Could you manipulate reality and matter within the explosive field of something like that? I mean, probably the question I should have asked Cobra when he was on is what are the effects of these bombs?
That's the big question, isn't it? Is it the classic? I mean, look. So I think Cobra's scenario is that the Earth is being held hostage, and it's essentially that we're like holed up at the embassy, right? The terrorists, the racket, whatever, have got this bomb that's going to blow everybody up if they try and encroach on them. And so what this team of theirs has to do is to very carefully disarm them, because they've got the key of this doomsday weapon, you know, the strangelet bomb. Doesn't sound nice. I mean, whatever it is, you know, we know that nuclear weapons are not good, and it must be worse. It must be like the top of the line expensive Raytheon thing, you know.
It sounds like an episode of Doctor Who is what it sounds
like.
Yeah,
totally. I mean, but I think Doctor Who I'm starting to come to the conclusion that you get more truth in the sci-fi series and in the satire comedies than you do on the news.
You very much do. If you looked at shows that ran for 5 years on the Sci-Fi Channel, the show Eureka, there was nothing in the program Eureka. I'm not sure if you got it over there. Did you ever get Eureka?
I've watched every one. I love it. I love it. I love it.
Like I'm telling you, they put, you know, it's Andy Griffith and Barney Fife at Area 51, basically, because everything in that show was real. Every single thing they talked about in that program, which was theoretical, and you can, if something comes out of the military where they're thinking about it. Oh, we might do this, we might do that. You can pretty much, they've been there, done that, you know, got the t-shirt, made the t-shirt, wore the t-shirt out, got a bunch of holes in it. You know, everything that has to do with that. And again, you have to look at the terrestrial and extraterrestrial aspect of this is that number one, you have corporate technology that is R&D stuff that's 3 to 5 years out from market, as an example. And all the R&D stuff that you're building is planned obsolescence. I mean, you and I both know that your iPhone, your computer will break a day after the warranty wears out. You know what I mean? It used to be like aluminum block engines in the United States. They had a 50,000-mile warranty on them, and I had a Chevy Vega, and that thing hit 50,010, and boom, you know, the whole thing explodes, and it's designed to break so that you buy new ones. Then you have a military level of technology. And the military level of technology is about, I would say, as far out between 10 to maybe 15 years out of anything that you've ever heard of. The way we know this, and I think that's a pretty good estimate of it, is that you can say that the SR-71 Blackbird, SR standing for Surveillance and Reconnaissance, while they were talking about U-2 spy plane, which was, you know, antique. It was the, you know, it was a supersonic jet compared to, you know, Orville and Wright's pedal-powered airplane. But we had the SR-71 Blackbird doing Mach 3 and maybe as high as Mach 5 at the same time that we were supposed to be flying this big goofy albatross wing plane that the Soviets were shutting down. You know, the Soviets with Gary Powers and all that were shooting down, which is just a complete joke. So SR-71 stayed top secret until 75, I think it was, about 75. So that's about 15 years or so. And then in 78, they retired the whole program. And then they never told you what they replaced it with. Well, now you've got, then you had to move the saucers into Area 51 back in like 86, 87 or so. And we back engineered a bunch of that stuff. And we started going out there to seeing it in 91 to 93. By the latter part of 93, all of it had been moved somewhere else. And we'd been sleeping in the dirt for like 6 months and hadn't seen anything. And we were told that it was all moved to Utah. But then we went back 10 years later. And we got caught right in the middle of a what they call a red flag war game where myself and my wife Melissa and these two Canadian girls that we hooked up with at the Little Alien out there, watched an entire war game with helicopters and jets and satellites and the whole thing, but with actual flying saucers, working in concert with these phalanxes of helicopters that had now been integrated into the war game aspect scenario. Now there was a piece of video, I think I sent it to you on the web, which did turn out to be fake actually. But you know, I think I've sent you the clips of the TR-3B Astra in action, stuff that was taken in the Inyo National Forest in northern Lake Tahoe. Then the one that the famous stuff that was taken in France in 2008. And did I send you the clip of them blowing up a Taliban village, and then you then see what looks like a TR-3B Astra triangular craft actually blowing all the stuff up?
I don't remember any of these. They sound really exciting. It did turn out that
the footage was rigged, and when you actually look at it real close, you can actually see that it's not even done very well. But it does look, and the thing for me was that the Astra was tan, and the quantum field in the center was static and was also tan, and so there was a lot of stuff that was wrong with the video. That then I started doing some more research on it, and I realized the whole thing was fake. But these things are now being directly integrated into the military, but then there's another level, JP. There's a whole level beyond that, and this goes back to the whole Da Vinci's demons thing on stars. This goes back to the 15th century and the Renaissance. That if you take Leonardo da Vinci and his invention of everything submarines and everything else, and you figure we haven't lost the technological advance for 500 years.
Right. Okay, we'll start there, Sean. We'll hang on with Leonardo and the Vitruvian Sean David Morton. Journeys with JP on Revolution Radio. Listener supported. Click the donate button. You know where to go. Buy the seeds. I think it's a very good idea. And tonight we waste no time, for this is high intensity and deep information we are discussing here. We're talking about Leonardo da Vinci, and he invented everything, and then since then, how come nothing else has been invented? Is that what you're saying? What's the deal?
Yeah, no, I'm just saying that if you there was a very interesting book that was called The Morning of the Magicians, and it talks about that if you put in perspective that maybe Jules Verne, who gave us all these fascinating previews of the future, I mean, he predicted nuclear submarines with 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. He predicted fax machines, the internet. If you look at H.G. Wells talking about the time machine and about the talking about time machine and, you know, all the things which, you know, maybe his wife wrote all the stuff. But if you understand that from about the 15th century in the Renaissance, at the same time you had Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Nostradamus, you know, at the same time you actually had the plague that was actually ravaging part of France, which a large majority of Europe at the time, that some people also said these weird men in black were behind, that maybe the Jesuits were behind that as well. But if you just look at it, had we never lost a technological advance, had we never had in Christendom the war against knowledge and against science and against technology, which always struck me as very, very strange, and also one of the major differences between Islam, which honored scientists and knowledge, and that anything of the scientific process was considered a exploration of the vastness and the energy and the will of Allah, if you will. Completely the opposite of how you see Islam today with its just complete buck ignorance. Had we not fought the various crusades, you probably, you know, had technology allowed to advance at that time. When you understand that the Catholic Church basically goaded Islam into the crusades by hiring these Red Cross Templars, actually. The Red Cross Templars were basically the Blackwater, the Academy, the XE of their day. And they were the ones who were tasked by the Pope to start a war with the Saracens, with Islam, so that the Catholic Church could either stop or delay the advancements of Islam. But again, had we never fought the Crusades, if you look at the paradise that was put here on Earth in Cordoba, Spain, in the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, which then ended in about 1195 AD or so. But you had, in Cordoba, you had one of the most amazing mosques and still one of the most incredible feats of architecture ever, one of the wonders of the modern world. But you had advanced medical practices. You had, ophthalmology, eye surgeries, brain surgeries. You had hot and cold running water. You had indoor plumbing. You had gaslit streets. And this is in the 9th century while the French are rolling around in the mud for, eating grubs. And, while the Europeans were all dying of plague, the Muslimmen were perfectly fine just because they believed in washing their hands, they believed in ritual ablutions. And, whereas even Louis Pasteur, who disproved spontaneous generation just by putting a screen over a jar of open meat. It still took almost 70 years for Western science to accept that spontaneous generation was a farce. So my contention is that had we never had the Crusades, we quite possibly would have landed an Arab on the moon probably around the 1850s or so with how things were going. But you'll notice that every time humanity gets to a point where we're about to take a quantum leap, this gigantic invisible hand sort of slaps us down. If you go all the way back to Leonardo da Vinci and you figure that, well, here's a guy who invents the helicopter, the airplane, the flying wing, the submarine, the diving suit, all these things, which is kind of fun. I know it's very fanciful and all that, but if you watch Da Vinci's Demons, even though it's a fairy tale retelling of Leonardo da Vinci, it's fascinating to see what we could have been. And did all of this knowledge go into a secret cabal of people? Are there beings on this planet, strictly human, mind you, that have technology that isn't just 10 or 15 years ahead, but 50 years ahead, maybe 100 years ahead? And I contend that, and this was where it really broke it for me. When we saw the flying saucers at Area 51, and between 91 and about 92 or so, we were begging the media to come out there. I mean, begging them to come out there with their cameras and help us and put this all over the place. And we were stumped every which way. The fact that we got this on the front page of the LA Times was remarkable. And this was February 26th, I believe, of 1991. And even then, they just made fun of us. Even then, they were just like, oh, we're just crazy people. We're out in the desert. Even though our car got swooped by a flying saucer, even though a group of about 50 people were sitting there watching one of these things flying over the range and testing very low in the valley, we had a photographer from the LA Times who specifically said, I was told to take pictures of people looking at UFOs, not to take pictures of UFOs. And he also stated that he had a Hasselblad portrait camera with a range of about 12 feet, which means that even if he took a picture of it, it wouldn't show up anyway. So, and then he goes, oh, and it's raining, and my camera's going to get wet, and I'm going home. So while we're sitting there with my friend Shannon Sands, who, by the way, is sitting here going, I can't see it because I'm night blind in one eye and I'm legally blind in the other. So they sent me a blind reporter as well. And even though all of us are looking at this thing flying around the valley, and myself and my friend Jeff had just had this thing swoop our car, and we chased after it, and we just got burned by it and all that. But then when you think of the shuttle that lands, what we were talking about the sonic booms and about the thing coming in, and now you're looking at something that's 1,600 feet long. You're looking at something that's the size of both the Star Trek and the military versions of the Enterprise. You have to think to yourself, okay, there are people on it. There are support systems for that. What keeps it in the air? What feeds those people? Where does it go if it's not on Earth? I mean, and years later, I talked to a government insider who said, oh, yeah, it wasn't calibrated correctly, and it landed three times because it had to be fixed, and it was a big nightmare. And I'm like, well, oh my God, so if it doesn't land on Earth, where does it go? And it puts you into, you begin to understand that just beneath the surface, in a kind of a banded laser form of communication, there are bases on Ganymede, one of the moons of, one of the moons of Jupiter. There's bases on, certainly lunar bases. There's certainly, there's quite possibly colonization of other planets like Mars, maybe Venus, what have you. And it's just something that we're not being told about. Or, you go to the next UFO possibility, and this goes to this UFO contactee friend of mine, this guy Audrey Ayn, out of Florida, out of Miami. He's a little Cuban guy who was riding on the spaceships with his girlfriend and taking photos inside the ships and out the window. And, you know, she was right there telling the story as well. And he claims that when the Germans began to move off this planet with their technology, that they were stopped by the Pleiadians and given a good stern talking to, if you will, and that there is a base in the Matamoros plain of Brazil, which he came back with photos of. I mean, you're talking UFOs that are about 100 meters across, which is about 300 feet or so, and there he is standing in front of four of them landing on these platforms, waving at the camera. And, you know, when somebody comes along with that kind of proof, and again, what are we doing? We're cobbling together this amazing quilt, this spectacular, magnificent mosaic of folklore and information. And eventually, the real shame of it is that you run through this marsh, this swamp of luminous weeds that eventually always leads you to this big black wall, this Zen cone that, where you don't know what the answers are. The only way you can glean anything is to talk to the abductees or the contactees or the people who've been there, the prophets, if you will, of the people who've been there, and then you've got to kind of just take their word for it. So, but if this technology is out there, it certainly means that there is a third path. You know, there's a first world, second world, third world, if you will, but there's another path of humanity that's doing perfectly well, thank you, that is moving out into space, that is colonizing this solar system, that may or may not get wiped out by some kind of Alpha Draconian invasion, you know, earlier next decade or so. But you know, and this goes along with my lines about that they're autocrats and technocrats, that the technocrats are freely and openly using the technology, but understand that releasing any of it would destroy the entire social, political, economic fabric of the earth. And they don't want that. They want the people in power to be in power. Although the technocrats really don't care. The technocrats are like, fine, you know, it's our job to make sure that, you know, these clowns like Barack Obama have a job, and that, you know, that they, you have the 8-year resident of the rented house at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And it's just their job to make sure that, you know, if the sheeple want this or they want that, to just allow the sheeple to have what they have and continue to be oppressed because they like it. And, once again, it's like in the movie The Matrix, where Agent Smith says, you're technically a virus, and you know, humanity really is a virus. It's not, we're not living in harmony with the planet, really. And I think the most telling thing about that film was he said, we created a paradise, it didn't work. We created a slave system, it didn't work. So now you have this, you have the pinnacle of your civilization, which is 1999, which really is kind of true, actually. 1999 really was kind of the pinnacle of it. That's, you know, that's right when a lot of the destruction sort of began. It was right around 2000, 2001 or so. And pointing out that it was the introduction by the Oracle in those movies of the illusion of choice that is what kept everybody in the cage. And Neo goes along thinking, you know, oh, it's all about choice, it's all about choice. And all the smart kids are saying, no, it's not. It's about control. It's about the illusion of choice that keeps you as the copper top in the battery, thinking that you can choose through all this time. So now that the veil is lifting on the right-hand side of the brain, as predicted by the Maya, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens if and when we get smarter and how that happens. There was one other book too. I'll recommend this to your book club out there. There was a Hugo and Nebula award-winning book that was written way back in the 70s. If you can even find it now, it was called Brainwave, and it was by a man named Poul Anderson, P-O-U-L Anderson. And, what happens is that the Earth moves out of a neural dampening field after 10,000 years. And suddenly everybody gets smart. Suddenly you have, I'm sorry.
Sounds like your cat has just arrived in the TARDIS.
No, yes, exactly. Yeah, the cat just, he just has this funny meow, and I thought that somebody, yes. Thank you, Spirit. Yes, the cat just wandered through from another dimension.
Your cat's called Spirit, right.
Yes, Spirit.
Thank you, Spirit.
Thanks, Spirit. Oh, Lord. Anyway, so
he's rolling around. Whenever I say, who's the handsome boy? Yeah, he rolls around. Anyway, so the point of all of this being is that if we're moving out into space, if we're creating this other reality, if we're doing what it is we're doing, and they're getting along just fine, thank you. It's, you know, how do you introduce all this new technology and not completely blow up everything on Earth? It's sort of like you try playing the God game, and you say, okay, you're God for a day, and anything you do will stick. And then you realize that anything you do that helps one group of people hurts another group of people. And anything, any technology that you introduce completely erases and throws other people into complete chaos. And who are you going to help and who are you going to hurt? Although, you know, I try to point out to people that between 1991 and 2001, the whole world got along just fine for a really brief 10-year period. We went through the greatest period of peace and prosperity in human history. There was more wealth legally created within a 60 square mile radius of downtown San Francisco with the computer industry there than ever in the history of mankind. And you only had two civil wars. You had Rwanda and Burundi, which people just went crazy. All these black people went nuts with machetes and just started slaughtering people in the town over. You had almost 2 million people die in less than 6 weeks, in I think 96 or so. And then you had Serbia, Bosnia, and Herzegovina, which is a civil war that's been going on for forever that I can't understand. Oh, they wear a red hat and I wear a blue hat, so they must die. But not a single war, not a single invasion, not a single war between two countries, massive technological advancements. It took a lot. I mean, it took a lot for the New World Order and the Illuminati guys to make us hate each other again. It took a real, 9/11 was one of the most spectacular magic tricks ever pulled in the history of mankind. And that's what it took to get us all to jump up and down. And even then, it didn't really work. Because even then, the agenda, which was really to go after Iraq in the first place, we couldn't figure out a way to pin it on them. So, you know, we go into Afghanistan, we get the heroin trade back up again. We got it rocking and rolling now at about $100 billion cash. We got Unocal building a pipeline through there, so we're pretty much done. We somehow managed to pin it on Saddam Hussein, even though we had nothing to do with it. And, by the way, they failed. And now you're seeing that they're failing in a lot of their conflicts. They failed in the war in Syria. They're failing to get their war with the Iranians. I think Putin is playing it masterfully. I mean, he's playing chess, and we're playing checkers. And he's playing the whole Crimea-Ukraine thing rather masterfully. And as I said, at some point we were going to go toe-to-toe with the Russians over Eastern Europe and about what was going to happen there. But, you know, there's a lot of other conflicts as well. I might point out one other thing also. That not only was Syria stopped and Iran has been stopped and a major war over Ukraine and Crimea has been stopped, but the mystery of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, there was a duplicate plane, exact tail numbers, exact serial numbers, the whole thing, that was sitting in an aircraft hangar in Tel Aviv. Not exactly the cheapest real estate on earth. And it had been sitting there for 5 months, and we're talking about a plane that cost $231.5 million, these Boeing 777s. And one of these aircraft, these mysterious aircraft, was turned away by various fighter jets because this airplane, I'm convinced, the reason that they tricked up they completely photoshopped the pictures of these two Iranians, these supposed Iranian terrorists that were on MH370, and they were so blatantly and clearly photoshopped that it wasn't even funny. But a plane matching that description was actually turned away on a flight path to the United Nations Nuclear Conference, and Jay Stone did some fantastic reporting on this, and that was the end game. To, on the one hand, you steal the plane, you tell the plane to turn around, you land it at Diego Garcia. The entire mystery is that you have the four people who work for Freescale Semiconductors out of Texas, who hold the patent, or the patent was actually then approved 48 hours later or so, but who hold the patent on a whole new generation of computer chips. You have about 20 scientists that all of whom had to do with the new black box encoding technology for what China is coming up with, because we can't crack any of their systems. We had Bill Gates go over there back in, all the way back, I think, 2004. It was the year that he went to the Bilderberg meeting, actually, and, you know, got all snotty about, well, you know, I own Microsoft, biggest company in the world. And some other guy goes, well, yeah, well, I own France. Who are you? And it's a... But he offered the Chinese all of the source codes. He basically said the same thing they were going to send Kevin Mitnick to jail for. Bill Gates goes to China and says, I'll give you all the source codes. I'll hand you Microsoft. I'll give you all the source codes for everything we do. And the Chinese were like, no, thank you, Round Eye. We've seen what Microsoft has done to people. We know that it's all backdoored and it's all coded and it's all, you know, virused out. And, you know, the Chinese knew that anything that they took from the Americans was going to come with a string and was going to come with a back door in it that they could shut down. So the Chinese turned away from all that, and now they've developed a black box encryption technology that we can't crack. So China's a complete enigma now. So there were the other 20 scientists on the plane were working on all that stuff. So now we've got them at Diego Garcia, basically, you know, torturing them to get whatever secrets out of that. And you then had prototypes for these next generation of fast charging, ion batteries that were also on the plane. And at the same time, you have a duplicate replica of the plane as well. You trick up the stuff about the Iranian terrorists and they were going to crash it into this big nuclear conference. And the plane was turned away. It was caught on radar. It was turned away you know, that's the name of that tune. So yet another kind of Jack Bauer 24 scenario that I think has been completely nullified. Whether or not this is by extraterrestrials or by the white hats or by the people actually in charge, but we should be in a whole bunch more trouble than we're in. And we know that they are bucking. I mean, they are picking a fight for another war and another terrorist attack and maybe an electromagnetic pulse of some kind. For all of us to have some kind of excuse to get in some major conflict to allow them to hyperinflate the currency to save the economy, which is basically what Bush did back in 2003.
Wow. So, quantum entanglement was the next thing that I wanted to bring up. Because, you know, he was talking about the Strangelet bomb and how the Strangelet bomb was made of, like, hyper-compressed matter, or maybe hyper-compressed Strangelets, however you do that, you know. So, excuse me, I'll just go and wind up my Strangelet press in the back garden. Anyway, I want to join a couple more dots because you were talking. I want to quantum join them, right? This is exactly what you're talking about.
Put a pin in that because a strangelet
is.
It's a hypothetical particle that consists of a bound state of roughly equal numbers of what they call up, down, and strange motion at a distance quarks. So its size would be a minimum of a few. What they call temtometers across with the mass of a light nucleus. And once the size becomes macroscopic on the order of meters across, an object is usually called what they call a quark star or a strange star rather than a strangelet. So an equivalent description is that a strangelet is a small fragment of strange matter. And the term strangelet actually originated with Farhi. And a scientist named Jaffe, because the strangelets have been suggested as a candidate of dark matter, and they're unstable because the strange quark is heavier than the up and down quarks. So strange particles, such as the lambda particle, which contains up, down, and strange quark, always lose their strangeness by decaying via what they call the weak interaction to lighter particles containing only up and down quarks. But the states with a larger number of quarks might not suffer from this instability, because this is the strange matter hypothesis of Bodmer and Witten, because according to that hypothesis, when a large enough number of quarks are collected together, the lowest energy state is one which has roughly equal numbers of up, down, and strange quarks, namely what they call a strangelet. So the stability would occur because of what they call the Pauli exclusion principle, having three types of quarks rather than two, as in a normal nuclear matter, allows more quarks to be placed in lower energy levels. But it's it's almost like an antimatter bomb. I mean, if you blew up a little tiny piece of antimatter, I mean, it would blow away Europe, as an example. Okay, so now take the pen out. Now we're going to talk about it. I just want to know what people know.
So strange matter. I mean, and there's the name of your show. So you're kind of Captain Strange, and there you.
Well, strange universe.
But strange universes are made of strange matter, obviously. And the image I'm getting of it actually is a bit like the version of a stem cell. Is that it could become something if it polarizes. So it's like it's a unified form, which then involves into matter becoming polar, and that's almost like the involving spirit coming into matter, coming into duality. You're seeing my analogy here.
Yeah, well, this is just a theory. I mean, nobody's proven this yet. It's just a theory. They're sort of like it's like cosmic rays can penetrate anything, and so, I mean, particle accelerators may have seen a strangelet, maybe, but if any of the objects that we call neutron stars can be shown to have a surface made of strange matter, then this would indicate that strange matter is stable at zero pressure, which means that we'd have to either do this in space or in some kind of anti-gravity field, which would vindicate the strange matter hypothesis. But there isn't any strong evidence for strange matter surfaces on neutron stars. I think what they're talking about is that also, when we were first studying time, here you go, here's something I'm good at. When we were first studying time, Dr. Fred Bell, as an example, I mean, he's 14 years old. He's actually going to the University of Michigan as a boy genius. And part of what they were doing is that they were studying, the heart of nuclear explosions. Any kind of explosion, actually, because any kind of explosion, actually, at the center of the explosion of matter, actually has a zero time field, if you will, a zero point energy or zero point time field. So, we were studying time dilation effects at the center of explosions, and that supposedly that's from the book Sands of Time, where, you know, when they had their little, I think Benji or whatever it is they called it, the little probe that they would then teleport into the heart of a Russian nuclear experiment. The whole point, you know, first off, they have teleportation, so they take the teleportation. They're using teleportation to do what? To study time. And now they're realizing that the first time that they had their first time travel incident was when they teleported one of these probes to the moon to cool it off, to then teleport it into the heart of a Russian nuclear experiment, to then bring it back to the surface of the moon to cool it off again, and then bring it into the laboratory so it doesn't come in as a screaming super hot radioactive mass that they have to deal with. But the minute that they began to teleport objects outside the morphogenic field of the Earth, then they got the very strange effects, which is when they got the time dilation effects. And apparently, in order to travel through time, you also have to travel through the astral plane. And the astral plane is all kinds of weird, creepy stuff in there. It's exactly like Ghostbusters, where you've got like weird, slimy things, you know, all coming through that area. But that's what we're doing. We're studying time dilations, and I would think that once again, a strange lit bomb would, I mean, it would just annihilate the solar system. It wouldn't be, you know, a very, very tiny piece of antimatter, as an example, would create you figure an atomic bomb has a fissionable mass that creates about a 6% nullification, which creates an atomic explosion. And then you have, what, a hydrogen bomb is maybe, I don't know, 10%. And then a cobalt cesium bomb would be 15%. But an antimatter bomb, you're looking at a nullification of upwards of 90%+. Which would then, again, if a hydrogen bomb takes, if a cobalt bomb takes out a 20 mile radius or something, you're talking about a little tiny piece of antimatter that would basically wipe out, oh, most of Europe, North Africa, you know, well into Russia, you know, and if you're talking about strangelet bombs now you're really talking about something that would destroy the entire planet.
Well, as you say, it would destroy the entire solar system, or a good chunk of it, possibly, and ruin maybe a lot more. And that's what they're holding us hostage with. Huh. That's their kingpin.
They put so much trouble into us. You really think that's the end game here? I mean, it seems to me like all the tens of thousands of years of progress and development and genetics and whatever else are just going to blow us up, really?
Well, that's the ransom, isn't it? That's the ransom. Yeah. The reason that they haven't invaded yet. The reason that they have to hide underground and in space, cloaked in. But tell me, what do you know about the relationship post? There was this incident at Dulce, and then things changed between the ETs, the Draconians, and the humans.
Pretty big time. I mean,
what happened?
What I do know is that the initial conflict at Dulce was a skirmish that I think about between 4 and 6 people died in, which was more of a misunderstanding that got really bad at about level 5 or so. We didn't go and clear the base out until, I think it was 87, I think it was. It was sometime, it had to have been, let me see, 80, 84, 80, 86 or 87. And it's so weird because the you know, the basis of Sands of Time, the, you know, there's a purposeful sort of altering that you don't really have a progression of events. You know, you hear presidents mentioned in passing, you hear certain administrations, you hear stuff about Reagan and all that, but the, but then we went up and we cleaned it out pretty well, I would say 86 or so, because by 89, as I told you, I was with a scientific team that actually then ultrasounded the Mesa. That proved it was there. That proved that there was a working nuclear pile at its heart. You could see the jet tubes. You could see all this various stuff. And it was there. It was because we took the challenge up of this UFO investigator, a guy by the name of Bill Moore, who wrote some books with Charles Berletz about the Bermuda Triangle. And Bill's an interesting guy, but he said that he was working as a spy and a disinformation agent for the government, and then he just made up everything about Dulce, and that he just released it into the UFO community to show people how stupid UFO investigators could be. And that just showed you how desperate they were to keep Dulce secret. I mean, I got a call from Harrison Schmidt, from Jack Schmidt, who was a geologist. He walked on the moon. He was with Apollo. So was he with Gene Cernan on Apollo 17? It was Apollo 17 or so. And he's my godfather. And, you know, Jack called me on the phone and said, you will not F with this place. You will not. You will leave Dulce alone. Don't go near it. Don't mess with it. Don't F with it. Don't, you know, you have no idea how much trouble you can get in. And, you know, that came from a former U.S. senator. So there was something going on at Dulce that we needed to know something about. Now, again, I just got finished reading a book called, you know, I got it right here, as a matter of fact. It's called Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of this book.
Oh, Serpo, that was the exchange program.
Yeah, the exchange program, and it was a book by Len Kasten. And it's a whole book that he wraps around a report about, I think, 13 people that then take a journey to Serpo, which is a world with twin suns. And they stay 13 years. They are only supposed to stay 10 years as part of this exchange program. And they wound up staying 13 because they couldn't measure time the same way on this planet because of the dual suns. And they actually kind of penalized themselves by staying 3 extra years simply because they didn't do the time properly. They didn't keep track of the time properly as to when 10 years was supposed to be. I think 7 people managed to finally return from the Serpo contact. You had 3 die. You had 2 people who stayed. So 7, it was more than that. One person actually died in transit. But, you know, and it's not very exciting. I mean, even this report was just very much that they were kind of, even they were warning us about the Greys, but they were telepathic and kind of empathic, and they just had this very simple society that was kind of agriculturally based, and they lived in these very simple houses and homes. It was almost like living on a farm, and yet they controlled these gigantically powerful starships and all this. So, I mean, even after reading the survey,
that sounds like me.
Very much, yeah. It's, you know, there's a respect and an awe amongst these beings, probably because they spend so much time in space. Of anywhere that grows trees, that grows plants, that has foliage and vegetation. In the Billy Meyer UFO case, they gave him a ray gun to play around with. And there's some famous, you know, there's some photos of Billy kind of brandishing this ray gun that, this Pleiadian cosmonaut named, Minerva, actually gave. Was Minerva? Yeah, there was Semyazi, Plasia, Minara, I'm sorry, Minara. Plasia was Semyazi's little sister. And that's kind of funny because Plasia, even though here she's on the spaceship with her sister Semyazi, with her older brother Quetzal, and their father Ptah, who was apparently the boss of the mission, you know, Plasia came down and she, in the Billy Meyer notes, she got obsessed with this motorcycle that Billy used to drive around, and she jumped on this motorcycle and she was gone. I mean, they didn't see her for days. She was just tearing around the Swiss countryside on this motorcycle. She thought that was the most fun she'd ever had. Meyer was then given this ray gun by Minara, and the first thing he does is shoot a hole in a tree with it. And you go there and you see the tree, and it's burned right through. I mean, you can not only see the burn hole through the tree, but it continues to go through the rock, and it burns a hole directly through the rock. And they were horrified and took the ray gun away from him and said, "Well, we're not gonna let you play with this anymore. Obviously, we're gonna shoot a tree." And because they're sacred to the Palladians.
That's right. You just hurt our friend.
Yeah. There was another big controversy as well, too, because part of the more interesting Meyer footage was Semyaza actually does these maneuvers where she takes her spaceship and she starts wrapping it around a tree, actually doing these maneuvers in a circle around a tree. And apparently the tree had been damaged by the radiation from the ship. And so they felt so bad about this, they actually took a trip back in time to then move the tree or do something to the tree, to literally go back in time to save the tree. And Meyer got in all kinds of trouble about it because when you actually go back to the spot where he films this, and it's so obvious that you see that, you know, you see the spaceship going around the tree so that you get this perspective, but Meyer was actually accused of growing like miniature trees and then having his miniature models and taking pictures of his models around these little tiny trees. And, so there was a whole big controversy because when you actually go to the location, the tree is gone. And that happens in a number of his photographs where you see glades that he's in where the ships are appearing and the glades have been cut back and gone because the Palladians actually alter time somehow to make sure that the plants aren't harmed. But that's neither here nor there. I'm sorry. So the Planet Serpo material was very interesting, which basically just shows, and the real sad part about this is that the Serpo mission, which ended about 1980 or so, is that these seven people that returned are never going to be heralded for being the pioneers that they are. They'll never get any credit. Most of them died of radiation years later. But the thing that's missed about Dulce is that you have a reptilian, Alpha Draconian, extraterrestrial aspect of this, and you very much have a terrestrial reptilian presence as well. What everybody seems to forget, and this was one of the things that when I lived in the monastery in Nepal at Tengbeche, the monks at Tengbeche, which is the highest monastery in the world, that's right at the foot of Mount Everest, the monks at Tengbeche very much believed in beings that they called the Naga Sirachi, which are a race of serpent men that live underground. They also believed that many of them were beneficent and wise and occasionally spoke to us and gave us wisdom, and others were vicious and ate human beings. And the best way it was ever explained to me was by Audrey Ayn, the UFO Pleiadian contactee from Florida, who said that Earth is in a contested area of space, that there was a reptilian prerogative, I guess you could say, or a reptilian plan to put reptilian evolved beings on the surface, which was then completely blotted out by this asteroid 65 million years ago. And, you know, there's other evidence that it wasn't an asteroid at all, that there was other evidence that somebody else showed up understanding that this was an evolutionary program by the Alpha Draconians and just hunted all the dinosaurs to extinction. Many people believe there's a radiation layer on the surface of the Earth, and there was a whole Ancient Aliens episode in this about this, that this radiation layer was pointed more towards a hunting the dinosaurs to extinction, if you will. But now you begin to realize that after this, even if you watch the TV show Cosmos, that after this great cataclysm, that basically nothing that weighed more than 200 pounds could really survive on the surface. So the dragons go underground into these huge velts that the Tibetans call Agharta Major and Agharta Minor. Agharta Minor is under the Gobi Desert, and Agharta Major, which is a gigantic, not a hollow earth, if you will, but a huge underground series of, it's an underground continent, which they have talked about for, you know, in Tibet for thousands of years, which was then physically proved to be there when the Chinese started doing nuclear tests in 1989. And it was in Time magazine, and they said, well, here you go, here's another Tibetan myth that has been proved. And they actually found these gigantic underground areas in, guess where, the Gobi Desert and the Himalayas. So I definitely think that there are archons, which are mentioned in the Bible, or watchers, as they're also called. You can also look in the book of Job as well, because it talks about the viceroys. If you look at a proper translation of the Bible, it talks about the viceroys, and it talks about the saucers and the whirlwinds, and how they come in and out of the earth, literally coming in and out of the poles. Once again, this is the book of Job. And the book of Job seems to have been a book that predates the Bible from the Sumerian civilization. It was an old, old story that was supposedly told by the Sumi way back, you know, several thousand years before, and from which the flood myth was taken, from which the book of Job, and we can look at the book of Job as quite possibly being the oldest book in the Bible. But it does talk about Satan, or Satan, which is actually Hebrew for lawyer, going back and forth to the palaces of heaven, accusing the faithful, and that his ships and viceroys come in and out of the earth, and, you know, all the UFO lore that's in there. But it's, there are rules of engagement. And I definitely think that they're set by some kind of higher power. As you saw by my, you know, In Sands of Time, you got a slight glimpse, and if I ever, you know, if I ever get a decent publisher and I ever get the other books published, Mr. Atkins plays a much bigger role in part two of the books, as being one of the people that is, you know, the valiant Thors, if you will, of the Mr. Atkins of the world, who represent this cosmic hierarchy that in essence says that unless we choose the right every day, unless we choose the good, that they will hand this planet over to be destroyed, that they're perfectly happy to let the Alpha Draconians come in and do whatever it is they're going to do. You'll notice that all of these mega corporations, if you notice, you know, ExxonMobil and Unical and Texaco, and, you know, with all this occult symbolism, all of them get their power and energy from things that come from under the ground. If they were in league with the Alpha Draconians or with the terrestrial reptilians, the Nagas Tirachi, if you will, look at what they're doing to the planet. Look at what all these corporations are doing. They've destroyed China. They're destroying India. But what are they doing? They're desertifying the earth, if you will. They're increasing the carbon dioxide contents. And it really hit me because on an episode of Cosmos, the other night, Neil Tyson Degrasse is saying that we are generating fields of energy and gases and clouds that have not been seen on this planet since the dinosaurs. And I thought, isn't that interesting? When I talked to a guy who was on the inside, and I did ask this question of Ted Humphrey when I said, are extraterrestrials actively working with the government? And his exact words were, young man, you shouldn't be asking that question. You shouldn't be asking whether or not extraterrestrials are working with the government, but whether or not extraterrestrials are, in fact, the government. And I also said, why are all these Navy bases always out in deserts? And, I mean, you know, the biggest naval facility we have out here is out in the middle of the Mojave, out in Death Valley. And he said, because lizards like the desert. And there was a Charlie Sheen movie, actually, years ago, called The Arrival. And Charlie Sheen is kind of on top of this. It was called The Arrival. And what he discovers is that these shape-shifting reptilians, it was David Icke's entire philosophy. He probably just saw this movie and started writing books about it. But these shape-shifting reptilians were setting up these plants all around the world that were basically dumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and terraforming the entire planet, which is in essence what we're doing with China and India and, you know, all these third world countries. We're terraforming the earth with these gases and whatever else that we haven't seen for 65 million years. So, and look who's doing it. It's the Exxons, it's the Mobils, it's these chemical companies. And who has the power? People that deal in everything that comes from under the ground, oil and gold and diamonds and whatever else. Could they be in league, you know, exactly like the Egyptians have said? It's the children of light, which is Isis and Osiris and Horus and Hathor, versus Seth, Sutekh, and the reptilian lords of darkness. And it was, according to the pyramid mythology, beings from Alpha Draconis that were responsible for the fall of man, that may have been responsible for the genetic engineering of mankind to then amplify the limbic system, which is the reptilian fear-based system. And it really is the limbic system that is the serpent in the garden that not only divides the brain between the male and the female, once again, the whole allegory of Adam and Eve, but it also creates a veil over the right-hand side of the brain that creates a fear-based module that literally stops the pineal and pituitary gland from properly functioning. And now, if we're moving into this new area of space, this is Paul Anderson's book, Brainwave, again, if we're moving into this new area of space and the veil is truly coming off the right-hand side of the brain, and if everybody is getting smarter and we are ascending, Poole Anderson brilliantly in his book, this is 74, mind you, he was saying that then governments started broadcasting signals and they started putting chemicals into the air and they started making people sick and they started putting satellites up that basically made people stupid and that people were happier when they were stupid. And there was a whole section of society that had to come together, and they eventually create a spacecraft that gets them off the planet, and they leave the planet to everybody that was retarded, that now have IQs of like, you know, 90 or 100 or so, you know, basically, I don't know, most of the Democrats, I think. But,
welcome to Planet Earth, Todd.
Yeah, Planet Earth Tards. Actually, there was one very funny scene in the book as well, where they send a rocket into space to see where the edge of this field was. and suddenly they pass the edge of the field without knowing it, and they all become too stupid to work the spaceship, and they're just like, oh, just all bumping into stuff, and you know, they can't figure out how to turn. And finally one guy gets a flash where he hits a button, and a failsafe button, that turns the ship around, so they go back into the field and makes them smart again. It's a very if I ever get some power in Hollywood, it's a very, very interesting film that predicted everything that's going on with the chemtrails and with high definition television and with cell phone towers and you know, everything else. So, you know, but the good news is that we really do win in the end, JP. There is a plan in place. There is a divine plot, if you will, where we eventually do come out on top. It's going to be dark and it's going to be dire. And it's going to be very Lord of the Rings scenario, but you know, we eventually win in the end.
Well, I've been reading some of your Vajra Chronicle
material. Okay.
I love it. I totally love it. Now, wasn't it in there that Vajra spoke about the flag with the snake coiled up?
Yeah, that's the flag of the North American Union, is the Don't Tread on Me flag.
That's right. And he talked about that.
Everybody's waving that now. Everybody's waving it all over.
Everybody's waving that. So that's a pretty spot on one, which makes it all the more scary. Now, I've been wondering, you know, what if, here's another scenario, between 1994, when you did this jump, and now, timelines have changed.
Yeah, they have.
Things have been altered. People have pushed the envelope of their consciousness and actually are making a difference in the edge of consciousness, of human consciousness, is pushing back against that stupidity field. And this is what we're trying to do on internet radio, little spheres, that will eventually join up like Frogspawn.
Right.
And until that time, we've been pushing against this kind of the stupidity field. I like that. And
the far side, Gary Larson calls it the boson layer.
The boson layer, exactly.
It's a far side cartoon where it's got the Earth, and it's just this atmosphere has a layer of clowns. And he says, you know, scientists discover the boson layer.
That's excellent. Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like, but he's so spot on, Gary Larson. I absolutely love Gary Larson. Is he still alive?
Yeah, he's just not doing comics anymore.
Isn't he? Oh, shame. Anyway, from the far side to the near side and to the dark side and to the strange side. So, quantum entanglement. You have some kind of patent for a device that I presume uses quantum entanglement to communicate on an instantaneous basis to any point in the known universe. Is that correct?
That was supposed to be
me. Yeah, yeah.
That was what we were.
I did it, but that one. Yeah, I was when I was 16. You know. Yeah.
well, had we been able to develop it, it was one of those things where. Using the equation in the book, hold on, I'm actually looking for the boson layer cartoon because I'm going to get it to you. There it is. Okay, hold on one second. I got to get this to you. All right, there it is.
We might be able to get this by the time you speak about it.
No. I'm just going to put it over on the Skype to you so that you have it. Okay. There it is. Okay, there we go. Ta-da. Oh, wait. All right, there it is. Oh, it'll do that, and I'll put it here. I can't
there
do
you
stuff
go,
right there on Skype. There you go. You got it now? It's right there on your Skype chat.
Yeah, I've got it.
Okay. And all right, so the equations in the book, the remarkable thing about the equations in Sands of Time, again, is there was a scientist in 1998 by the name of Heinrich Mueller. And Heinrich Mueller, I met with representatives of Heinrich Mueller when I was in Lake Constance. Actually, I was doing his European speaking tour with Kerry Cassidy, and in Lake Constance, these people came to me and they said, you know, we heard you mention Heinrich Mueller and we're associated with him. And apparently, Heinrich Mueller, because they're now after him in Germany because his science is so advanced. that people are saying that, well, you're guilty. Only in Germany can they supposedly throw you in jail or sue you for having a scientific theory that disappears with most of the laws of physics, I guess. And now they've supposedly found him guilty of fraud for whatever reason, for violating the laws of physics, according to them.
So someone that's actually to be fined for breaking the laws of physics is a pretty much a only the Germans could do such a thing.
Yeah, Germany, that
you are violating a philosophical rule.
Exactly. Apparently in Germany that's a pretty big deal. So, but what happened with Mueller is that he had a device. And he was in Munich, and these other guys were in St. Petersburg. And what was happening with the device is that this device could instantaneously communicate without the use of radio or wires or anything else. So they turn this thing on, and it's transmitting from Munich, and there's a slave device that then is picking up the signal in St. Petersburg simultaneously. So they need to run this for several hours to make sure that it's an instantaneous transmission with, no wires, no connections, no nothing. So they play, they're German, so they play like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony into this thing. And, they're sitting around talking and they're playing this, to be able to get a standard frequency on it. When they go back and they analyze the data, they find that the two boxes, the master and slave box, that the slave box goes out of phase with the master box, which they then thought the experiment was a failure. Because it went out of phase, then it meant that the transmission was not instantaneous, and the experiment would have failed. What's the point of having something that's not instantaneous over space? Then they began to realize that the slave box was out of phase because it was actually reading the signal that they were sending before they sent it. Which means that somehow the Ninth Symphony that they were sending, that the box itself was actually folding time-space and picking up the information before it was being sent. Now, if you understand the ramifications of that, using the equations in, and this is what I applied for the patent for, patent pending, and we couldn't get anybody to fund it. It would have taken probably about $2 million to do. But the idea was to be able to come up with a cellular phone type device that could transmit from an independent source. You wouldn't need cell phone towers, you wouldn't need satellites, you wouldn't need anything. You can actually just simply transmit into you can simply transmit into the ethers, if you will. And not only is it instantaneous and instantaneous transmission, but you could actually transmit to anywhere in the universe instantaneously. So this means that you could communicate with a spacecraft in the orbit of Pluto and in real time actually work it with an Xbox controller if you wanted to. But that was the whole point of the equations and why I applied for the patent on it, because I thought that, oh wow, gee, well, people will see this mathematical equation and understand, its worth, which of course nobody ever did.
Another one of those failed projects because you launched before your time.
Yeah, that was pretty much it.
Yeah, but it might all come together. The TV series, the mathematical equation, the radio series, the books. It might all just be like a huge launch package.
I suppose. The challenge with the cell phone idea was that you can't put a big red button on it and stop it. A government would not be able to control communication at all, and that's not what they want in the least. Matter of fact, that they were so angry at Skype because Skype was uncrackable. Skype was, when you were doing a video call on Skype, you were transmitting over 9 different frequencies, and the National Security Agency put out a $1 million bounty, if you will, reward for anybody that could figure out how to work Skype, how to crack Skype. And this is a government agency saying, we can't spy on a computer modality, and we're willing to pay $1 million to somebody that can show us how to do it. This is a government agency saying this. And when they failed with anything they could crack Skype, Steve Ballmer comes along, and for $8.8 billion, he buys Skype. So now Skype belongs to Microsoft, and now Microsoft, which is all part of the military-industrial complex and is all being run with Google and everything else, therefore now Skype goes away as something that is inviolate.
Yes, well, this is where we come in with Wicca, W-I-C-K-R. If everybody gets Wicker, then it slows down the NSA and it causes them to use up terabytes upon terabytes of hard drive space, queuing up each of these PGP packets that has to be cracked because it goes in the list. So okay, there's something to do. Wicker, W-I-C-K-R.org, or I think it's .com, probably .org. And it's a secure, like a Skype thing, for smartphones.
Okay.
Yeah, so this was, recommended by one of Kerry's guests, and he was the, oh my god, he was the phone freaker guy. He said, this is what we have to do, is to basically queue them up, back up their queue, send loads of encrypted packets saying, I'm just going down the chip shop, I'm just coming back from the chip shop, and, you know, stuff like that, to clog up the NSA's computers and their, queues of cracking. So they've got these huge farms of, you know, AI computers, cracking as much of the, PGP code as they can, but, it takes time. And, so
well, it's probably what they're doing out in Bluffdale, as you have the Bluffdale facility, out in Utah. And here you have all these computer servers. They build their own power plant right next to it to power the servers. And now they can't, and now the power plant doesn't have enough power to power the servers, and they can't get the water that they need to actually cool anything. So now they're having all these fires, which just goes to show that human stupidity beats artificial intelligence every time.
Every time. Sean David Morton, thank you very much, Captain. We'll be back next week. We've got some fantastic people coming on. Bless your heart. Thanks very much, Sean. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you, buddy. You're the best.